Welcome to Translating Aging, a podcast about how the science of human longevity is transforming the way we treat disease. In each episode, we bring you conversations with the researchers, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who are working at the vanguard of the field. Translating Aging is produced by BioAge Labs, a clinical stage biotechnology company that is harnessing the biology of human aging to develop targets and therapies for metabolic disease. I'm Chris Patil, VP of Media at BioAge. Today, we're joined by Dr. Noah Davidson, co-founder and chief scientific officer of Rejuvenate Bio, a biotech startup taking an innovative gene therapy approach to treating chronic age-related disease. Dr. Davidson earned his PhD in biological engineering at MIT, and as a postdoctoral fellow, he joined Dr. George Church's lab at Harvard Medical School, where he focused on breakthrough genetic therapies for age-related diseases. Rejuvenate Bio launched out of George Church's lab and the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard University. Noah, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
To get started, for those of our audience who haven't heard about your company before, could you provide just kind of a simple overview of Rejuvenate Bio's mission and approach, and maybe something about what makes it unique in the longevity biotech space?
Our goal is to treat and reverse all aging and age-related diseases. It's a very large goal, but you know, take small chunks out of it as you go. We have a couple of initial targets where we're going after specific age-related diseases using longevity-associated genes that have been shown to make mice live longer and healthier lives. So not only will we be able to treat the specific age-related disease we're going after, but we should also be able to treat and make you holistically healthier and better, and a number of comorbidities that would normally be associated with that disease. Once you get heart failure, you're more likely to be obese. Once you're obese, you're more likely to have heart failure. And so if we're able to treat heart failure, then we should also be able to help and prevent the comorbidity that would normally be associated with the initial disease. And just generally making people holistically healthier and better.
Right. And that's one of the catechisms of our field, that because aging is the primary risk factor for so many chronic diseases, that if you successfully treat one of the root causes of aging, you're likely to have knock-on effects beyond the initial indication that you test in clinical trials that benefit the health of the patient down the road.
That's exactly right. And you know, our first targets are going after genes that are very well characterized in the longevity field. For instance, our first target is FGF21. And this is, you know, exciting. Nobody's really translated these longevity things directly into patients yet. And then our follow-on targets are more in the age reversal space, which is, you know, our new publication that just came out that we'll talk about a little later, where we're actually doing true age reversal, resetting the cell state back to an earlier time.
Actually, you said you wanted to talk about it later, but I say no time like the present. You and your co-authors recently published a groundbreaking paper showing that partial cellular reprogramming using a subset of the Yamanaka factors extended lifespan in very old mice when delivered via gene therapy. First off, before we get into the model system, in the least specialized terms that you can muster, what is a Yamanaka factor?
Yamanaka factors were genes that were discovered that were able to take an adult cell and turn it back into a stem cell. And it's a very unique ability. Normally, you only see something like this when you're reproducing. You take, you know, a specialized sperm cell and a specialized egg cell, combine them, and they're able to reset all the way back to zero and start with a whole new organism. But the Yamanaka factors were able to do this in adult cells without that specialized extra machinery that normally comes along with sperm and egg cells.
That is to say, you didn't have to turn the cell into an egg first in order to reset it into a stem cell.
Going from an adult cell to a pluripotent stem cell, which is what the combination of an egg and sperm are, is a very complicated process that you need powerful tools. And the Yamanaka factors are those powerful tools that allow us to completely wipe the epigenetic state and turn an adult cell into a stem cell.
Okay. But in an old mouse, you don't necessarily want to turn its cells into stem cells. You want to turn back the clock while retaining their differentiated identity, right?
Correct. Right now, the Yamanaka factors are a really great tool, but it was designed such that you could take an adult cell and turn it into a stem cell. We're repurposing that tool because the state of the cell, the cell identity, and the age of the cell are currently convoluted. And so when you reset the epigenetic state of the cell into a stem cell, you actually are de-aging the cell at the same time. we want to take advantage of the ability of the Yamanaka factors to de-age the cell, but we don't want it to lose its cell identity. We want a liver cell to stay a liver cell. We want a neuron to stay a neuron. We just want to make it a young liver cell and a young neuron. And so that's where that idea of partial reprogramming comes into place. We only have the Yamanaka factors on for a short period of time to get the de-aging benefits without the cell identity downside.
I see. So rather than drive the system as hard as you can and can knock the cell all the way back to a pluripotent stem cell, you give basically a short dose of the Yamanaka factors, and that allows you to de-age without de-differentiating.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's the key technology here, is the control system that's going to allow us to get into, you know, human patient populations.
So could you tell us a little bit about that control system?
Yeah. So for the paper, we used a standard TRE doxycycline system, but that is, in my mind, it's bacterial based. So there is potential problems for immunity when you go into human patients, putting bacterial genes into humans. And so we've developed a novel inducible system that will allow us to take this technology and actually develop it into a therapeutic for humans.
And it doesn't involve bacterial genes?
Correct. It is smaller. You can use any different inducer molecule you want. It can be designed around different inducible molecules. For instance, you could use different FDA-approved drugs, so you don't have to do a dual clinical trial, both for the inducer molecule and for your therapeutic. You could just do your therapeutic and use something that has already been approved by the FDA and everybody knows that it's safe and well-tolerated. Or you can use one of these molecules that are classified as GRAS, generally recognized as safe. You know, for instance, caffeine is one of those molecules that is on that GRAS list. Like, we've never done a clinical trial, but everybody knows it's pretty safe because everybody ingests it every day. You wouldn't want to use caffeine.
I'm sorry. Yes, exactly. I was waiting for you to get to that. You would not want to use caffeine to control a system of this power. But the point is well taken that you have a lot of options.
Right. And the key here, as we previously mentioned, is we don't want to de-differentiate the cell. So we want to be able to specifically and tightly control when the genes are on and off. And this new system that we've developed, I can't really go into more about it, but the new system we've developed allows us to do that in a way that will be regulatorily friendly and practical in terms of a therapeutic.
That's fantastic. And it's convenient that the biology is cooperative, that you can de-age before you de-differentiate. That is to say that the lower, shorter exposure to the Yamanaka factors gets you the thing that you want, and not the thing that you don't want.
Yeah, there's a lot of work going on around that. And it seems like there's resistance to the cell becoming a stem cell. And so even if you de-identify the cell a little bit, it relaxes back into its cell type. So I think biology in this case is actually working for us, where we're able to remove a lot of those epigenetic marks and get rid of the aging components. And then the cell has a natural proclivity to turn or stay into the cell type that it is.
Yeah, this is reminding me of some theoretical paper I read years ago about the idea that the differentiated states of cells were kind of stable attractors from the standpoint of complexity theory, and that, like, if you perturb away from them, there are a lot of mechanisms that'll tend to drag the cell back to where it was in the first place. So that's cool that the biology is cooperating in that way.
Yeah, if you put like a stem cell inside an organism, it will want to differentiate towards something.
Right. Cool. All right, so let's stipulate that you have this cool system and you have a lot of control over the time of exposure to the Yamanaka factors, and you told us enough about it that we can understand generally what's happening. So what did you do with this system to the mice in your study, and what did you find?
I think the key thing for our study in mice was that we looked at the experiment as if it would be something that we would want to develop for humans. And we used super old mice, as you mentioned, akin to an 80-year-old person. Generally, you see in the longevity field that people use either young mice or middle-aged mice because the longevity therapeutics need time to accumulate that benefit. And here we're actually going for reversal. And so we want to get as old as possible because the patients that we're going to be treating are going to be very old and have lots of problems. So an 80-year-old person is the exact demographic that we'll hopefully be treating at first because they're the ones who need it the most. And so the mice, we're trying to recapitulate the humans that we'll eventually be treating.
Right. And I just want to interrupt you and point out to the audience that this is a really powerful idea, and it's a really important idea. Like, a lot of, you know, so-called longevity interventions, they're like, this works great. All you need to do is start when you're very young and do this treatment your entire life. And unfortunately, for people who have already undergone the aging process, molecules that require you to have lifelong exposure to the intervention in order to work aren't going to be helpful. So it's really important if we're going to truly reverse even a subset of the symptoms and consequences of aging, that we have interventions, that we develop interventions that work in organisms that have already been old and have not had the benefit of an intervention prior to that point. You said it well yourself. I just wanted to reiterate it for the audience. This is a really critical difference between this approach and certain other kinds of small molecule approaches to slowing the aging process.
That's exactly right.
So you put this in the old mice, and what did you see?
We saw a doubling of the remaining lifespan.
Give us some numbers here.
If you're 80 years old and you were going to live to 100, and given this therapy, now you're going to live to 120.
I see. So if you had 20 years of remaining life left, it would double it to 40. Can you tell us what the actual numbers were for the mice? Like, how old were they in mouse time or just real time? How much longer were they going to live without the intervention, and how long did they actually live?
Basically, it had about a 3-month increase in life expansion. Toward the end, the mice have not that much time. We actually intervened when a little more than half of the mice had already died. And that's, you know, why we chose the quote-unquote 80-year-old person. The mice were about when half the population had died already.
And were the mice living longer but in poor health? Sorry, that was a ridiculously leading question.
Yeah, sorry. No. They were not. We measured frailty index as well. So this is a metric of health span. It looks at a number of different things: fur color, whether they have a hunched back, how active they are, their grip strength. So this is a functional health metric. And they had increased health compared to the control. So not only did they live twice as long, they also had increased health. So this is increasing number of healthy years. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, a very key thing that everybody's always worried about. You know, you don't want to be decrepit, you know, forever. Everybody's like, oh, you'll live forever, but you'll be like in this terrible state. You won't be able to, like, you'll be in a wheelchair. You won't be moving around. You won't be cognitively there. This is an increase in health and lifespan. I think that is underappreciated for these technologies, that when they increase your health span by reversing aging, you're going to get an increase in health concomitantly with that.
Right. I think the catchphrase is, we want to add life to years, not just years to life.
Yes. Yes.
That sounds really fantastic. And what I'm curious about, I'd like to bring it back to Rejuvenate Bio. How does the approach that you demonstrated in this mouse study connect to the therapies or gene therapy approaches that Rejuvenate is currently developing?
This is our third therapeutic in our pipeline. We will likely go after some neurological diseases to start for this age reversal therapeutic. You know, some of the worst kind of diseases that humans encounter are when we lose our ability to think and, you know, be and converse with the people we care about. And we want to reverse those diseases first, because they're some of the larger, harder problems to tackle. And this is a very powerful tool that can be used to tackle those hard to treat problems.
Nice. So before we dive into like the plan at Rejuvenate and the future of your clinical development, there was one question that I meant to ask you earlier, which was, it's really cool that you can take about 2 years old when you started with them?
Yes, a little more than 2 years, about 29 months.
Okay. It's really cool that you can take a 29-month-old mouse and give it 6 months of life, 3 more months than it would have lived. One question that's sort of obvious to me is, do you think you'd get a comparable benefit in terms of increase in remaining lifespan if you started with a younger animal? And do you have any plans to do those experiments?
I think you would get an increased benefit the younger you started, because, you know, even with this technology, what you generally see in the longevity field is that you have follow-on, knock-on, compounding effects the earlier you start. And I think there's more optimization to be done for this therapeutic as well. This experiment was done with what I would call an unoptimized system. We took kind of an off-the-shelf system, modified it slightly, and put it back in mice to see what would happen if you systemically gave a age reversal therapeutic. And we were very pleasantly surprised to see such a large effect. And only small optimizations would potentially increase this even better, getting it to more cells, getting it to more cell types, and then having better expression in those cells. And so I think very small things could actually increase the benefit of this, as well as if you gave it, you know, when they're 20 months old instead of 29 months, what would that do? Would it double remaining lifespan at 20 months? And I think that would be incredible. You get a mouse living for 4 years instead of 3 years.
Well, the other question is just, you know, could you do it more than once in the same animal? Like, is there any reason why this is one shot? Or could it, you know, you, if you're truly reversing aging, right? If we say that that's a well-defined thing, I'm not sure that it is. But if you say, yeah, okay, we reversed aging, you know, in a 20-month-old animal, we've knocked it back to where it was at 14 or 12 months, and then it moves forward in time again and hits that 20-month mark. Like, presumably, some of the reasons why that mouse is not as healthy as it was right after the initial therapy is that it's undergone aging. Could you then do the same intervention again?
The nice thing about gene therapy is that once it's delivered, it's there permanently. And so the inducible molecule is the ability to do what you're saying.
Right.
So you just keep on giving the inducible molecule and you keep getting more therapeutic benefit. If you give the gene therapy again, I don't think you would necessarily enhance that.
I retract my sloppy statement of the idea. Like, what I meant is the thing that you are saying, that, you know, if you turned on the system for 20 months, right, and rolled the clock back, and then the animal aged again, could you then hit them with the inducing agent and reap a benefit? Like, it sounds like you haven't done those experiments in terms of serial treatment, but what would your prediction be?
Well, to clarify, for this paper that we just published, we were cycling the inducible molecule every other week. So we turned the system on every other week for the rest of their life. So we tried to get maximum de-aging with minimum reprogramming. And traditionally, it seems like from the literature with the Yamanaka factors, it takes, you know, somewhere between, let's say, 3 to 5 days at a minimum in the best case scenario to close to a month to reprogram a cell into a stem cell. And so in vivo, I think we were thinking that it wouldn't be as efficient. And so 1 week on and 1 week off seemed to be that sweet spot where you turn the clock back and then let it turn back into the cell and not have any of that input, and then do it again. So just keep on maximizing that. So you might not have to do that clinically in humans. You might be able to do a treatment for a month and then, you know, wait another year or two and then do another treatment. It could be even that powerful where you're saying, like, okay, we're going to do an initial treatment that's going to reset things, and then we'll wait a couple of years and reset things again.
Fantastic. Well, there's clearly a lot of potential here. Very exciting, very cool paper. And I really appreciate you going into the technical details and clarifying that misunderstanding I had about how the experiment was actually done. So moving back now to kind of the main line of effort at Rejuvenate. So you're a rare company in that you're pursuing clinical programs in two species, dog and human. So I'm a human, and I want to talk about our species first. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Okay. So your lead program targets FGF21, which is a longevity-associated gene, to treat multiple, and I would dare say diverse, age-related conditions to which you alluded above. So first of all, what led you to focus on this target?
So I did a literature search when I first started in the church lab, and I came across a number of different longevity experiments that have been done, and FGF21 was one of the better ones. The mice lived close to 30% longer. And then I think started thinking about the practical nature of turning these genes into therapeutics, and gene therapy seemed to be the best modality. Then I looked at how well gene therapy had progressed, and now we're talking 2012, so 12 years ago, where I was looking into these things. And AAV was really good at getting the liver, but not so much at getting a lot of other tissues. So I thought the best thing to do would be to choose genes that had the biggest impact on longevity and was amenable to a liver-directed gene therapy. That way, we don't have to deal with the complicated nature of getting into every single cell that we're trying to treat. We get into enough cells, we create a therapeutic biofactory in the liver, and then that is able to holistically get the entire organism.
Got it.
And so FGF21 seems to be like a magical panacea protein. It's able to increase mitochondria in muscle and heart, decrease inflammation, is metabolically active. It will make you weigh less. And it seems to have like a better profile than these GLP-1s, GLP-1s, in that you don't necessarily lose muscle mass. So that's a very attractive thing. It decreases cholesterol. It is able to decrease fibrosis as well. And we saw that from the recent Akero trial where they, and 89 Bio, in MASH disease. So I think it's a very exciting, fun target. And I think it has a diverse, holistic benefit across the organism. It's also been able to show an increase in immune function in mice as well.
Do all of these benefits come from liver-targeted manipulation?
So it's naturally produced in the liver. And when you have these transgenic mice, that's when they change the gene and breed it into the mice so that they're constantly overexpressing it from birth. Those mice are just producing more of it in mostly the liver, but also in the muscle as well. So we're trying to mimic the natural production of FGF21 by doing a gene therapy directed at liver transduction. It is mimicking what's happening naturally, as well as what's happening in these transgenic mice where all the data is being generated for FGF21.
And FGF21 is a circulating factor, right? Like, it's not like a protein that like plunks itself into the membrane of a cell and stays put. It moves around in the blood. Am I right about that?
Exactly. It gets secreted from the liver and goes everywhere.
Okay. Right. That kind of answers the question that I was bugging you with above. I mean, it only has to be made in one place and then it can get to other places and have all these diverse effects that you were citing. So you mentioned a lot of different indications for which it might be useful, or a lot of potential organ and tissue specific benefits. What are the clinical indications you're going to pursue first? And just to remind the audience, like, as beneficial as a medication might someday be to multiple indications, like, in order to do a clinical trial, one has to basically choose one and test it for that. So what do you think is the way forward for this gene therapy?
We've seen some best-in-class data for going after arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy in humans. This is a disease where you have arrhythmias that can cause sudden cardiac arrest or death and eventual heart failure, because it has a lot of fibrosis that accumulates and decreases the function. And what we're seeing with our FGF21 therapy is that we're able to basically eliminate the arrhythmias from this disease. That's because it helps with calcium signaling and generally the heart cell function with the mitochondria, the inflammation, all of those things I just mentioned are present in this particular disease. And it's a rare disease in humans, so we think it's a great first shot to go into this patient population because they have a huge unmet need. And it seems like our therapy directly matches with the specific disease measurements that we would be taking in this patient population.
Great. And it looks like down the road, from what you were saying, you could have potential applications in many other diseases, including, I noted, obesity.
It's actually first been shown to treat metabolic diseases, and then people started to look into it for its ability to work in different areas like the heart, and we were one of the first ones to look at it in the kidneys as well. It's a very exciting molecule, and so you can imagine that we first start with arrhythmogenic cardiomyopathy in this rare population of heart disease, move to more generalized heart diseases, just a myocardial infarction, for instance. And then you could also move into metabolic space where you have general obesity or diabetes, because it's an insulin sensitizing protein. So you should be able to reverse the effects of type 2 diabetes as well.
Why do you think so many aging companies end up working on obesity?
It's mostly because it's one of the more prevalent problems with modern society that is a very well-known decrease in longevity, right? So if you look at a lot of the work done in the longevity field, it's about metabolic handling and calorie restriction, for instance, makes mice live longer, makes monkeys healthier, you know, and we're hoping that it also can make humans healthier by doing a little bit of calorie restriction, decrease cancer and so forth. And so in a world of abundance that we currently live, obesity and diabetes is one of the largest problems that is a knock-on effect of a lot of other comorbidities, right? So once you have obesity, you can have MASH, you can have heart problems, you can have neurological problems from obesity as well. So I think obesity is one of the most prevalent things decreasing the health and longevity of humans today. And so that's why in the aging field, you end up in the metabolic space, is just because of how prevalent the problem is.
That's very exciting for your human pipeline. Now I want to move to the other species. Rejuvenate's made a strategic choice to develop gene therapies to treat age-related diseases in dogs as well, including mitral valve disease, before moving on to human trials. So before I pepper you with questions about that, could you tell us about that program?
Yeah, the same type of therapeutic that we're using in humans was used in dogs already. And this goes back to actually why I even started Rejuvenate in the first place, is I got my dog Bear and I wanted to make him live a longer, healthier life during my postdoc. And that, so I started to think about like what would be the ways to develop a therapeutic within his lifetime that I could give to him to make him live a longer, healthier life and disease-free as well.
How old is he now?
Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, he had a basically the ALS of dogs. It's called degenerative myelopathy.
Oh, goodness.
The therapeutics weren't ready to give to him. His disease was found kind of late and rapidly progressing. So,
well, I'm very sorry for your loss, but it sounds like the inspiration still lives on.
He does. Yeah, the inspiration is definitely from him. And, you know, I hope that nobody else has to lose their pet in the future. So I still am trying to go toward that goal of getting this therapy out for both dogs and people.
Yeah. So tell us, what is mitral valve disease? And is it very common in domestic dogs?
Yeah. And so it's almost an opposite strategy from humans in the sense that for humans, you regulatorily, it is more attractive to go after these orphan patient populations that are smaller. It makes clinical trial design a little bit easier with a smaller number. Whereas in the dog population, you want to go after the biggest disease you can because the market is a lot different for dogs. It's about, you know, 100x smaller than humans. So you want to have a very large number of patients. And mitral valve disease is about 7% of all dogs. And there's about 80 million dogs in the US. So you're talking millions of dogs.
Did you say 70%?
No, seven.
Okay.
7%.
But still millions of dogs, right? As you say.
Yep. Still, yeah. And it's a huge problem. And there is a drug on the market. It treats the symptoms of the disease, but doesn't really treat the underlying pathology. And since we're agnostic pretty much to the source of the problem in the heart generally, we thought we'd be able to treat mitral valve disease as well. And what we see in people's pets with mitral valve disease, we've done a pilot trial at Tufts University with people's pets that have mitral valve disease. And we're seeing almost a 2-year increase in lifespan and health, and their hearts are still functioning as if they were somewhat normal hearts. And so it was very exciting to get that data. We were seeing the durability, the safety of our therapy in the real world in people's pets. So we take it out of the lab and you're able to do this much more quickly than you would normally for humans. And there's still a huge market opportunity there.
Yeah. So this program's quite advanced. I mean, how long do you think it could be before it's available to dog owners out in the world?
Yeah, there's something called conditional approval for dogs as there is for humans. And right now we're about 2 years away from getting that process complete. The long straw for gene therapy in general is manufacturing. It's a more complicated process than a small molecule, and it takes a little bit longer to get all the checks, check all the boxes for the FDA to make sure it's ready for prime time. But yeah, so about 2 years away, and theoretically, then we'd be conditionally approved for mitral valve disease, and you'd be able to get it at your vet.
That's amazing. So to change gears a little bit, by treating age-related conditions in dogs, starting with MVD, moving from there, you'll be able to gain some long-term data on the effects of your gene therapies on lifespan and health span in dogs. And I'm wondering what you hope to learn from the canine patients that could inform your approach in humans.
Yeah, I think the nice thing about the animal health world is that, especially dogs, they share our environment, they eat the same food, and they have a lot of the same age-related diseases as we do. And so FGF21 also decreases incidence of cancer and neurological disease. So it would be interesting to see if we have it in enough dogs, if you're seeing just a decrease in all-cause mortality across the board. And, you know, when you have an approved therapeutic that can be prescribed off-label with a really great safety profile, and generally using longevity drugs, I think has the potential for a much better safety profile than other drugs because they've already been proven to have the side effect of an increased health and longevity. So I think it's an interesting place to start for a therapeutic in general from a safety perspective. And so I think if the drug is safe enough and the benefits are potentially large enough that you could have it in a very large number of patients and see this decrease in all-cause mortality across the board.
So what's next? I mean, you said that you were working on the manufacturing of this gene therapy in dogs. Are there any other upcoming milestones that you're working towards right now?
For the animal health space, the goal is conditional approval, and then we would start our pivotal efficacy while conditional approval is ongoing, very similar to the way the human conditional approval works as well. And then we recently had a partnership with another leading animal health player for our second therapeutic for osteoarthritis. And this is a combination of anti-TGF-beta-1, so generally inflammation and fibrosis, as well as overexpressing Clotho. And so we've seen some really interesting data in rats for osteoarthritis, and we're looking forward to testing it out in dogs as well. And that would follow a similar timeline and path to our mitral valve disease product, and hopefully be in dogs within the next 3 to 5 years as well.
Thinking about the target tissues of these two programs, where do you need the gene therapy to go in the body in order to get them to work? Is it liver targeted again, or do you actually need to get into the joints in the case of osteoarthritis, or the heart in the case of MVD?
That's the interesting thing about doing these specific genes, is that I chose the genes such that they were secreted genes that will go everywhere. And so we don't have to worry about that aspect of getting it into the cells that are the problem, because I didn't think when I started, gene therapy wasn't really there to make sure that it could get 100% of all cardiac cells and 100% of all, you know, chondrocytes in the joints. So I wanted a way to still get the effect 100% in all the tissues I cared about without having to worry about delivery, because delivery is still one of the key problems with all these genetic medicines, is making sure it gets to where you want it to go.
I'm really glad that we revisited this point, because I think that I was being a little bit dense about it. We talked above about FGF21 and how it's a diffusible or a circulating factor, and that's why you don't have to make it at the site of action. And I think I hadn't quite learned the lesson enough, and that's why I asked the question I just asked. And you did a really good job of reminding me that, like, when you have a factor that can move around in the blood, you do not need to make it in every tissue. You do not need to make it in the target tissue. You just have to make it somewhere where it can get into the blood and then go forth and do the things that it does in the body.
Yeah, it'd be akin to getting an injection, you know, every day or every 5 minutes to make sure that those levels stay high. But it's happening from a one-time injection, and it's happening in your liver. So I think you get the benefits across the board of having these increase in proteins without having to have numerous injections or pills every day.
Why is the liver the place where it's relatively easy to get gene therapy vessels and vehicles in?
It's the cleanup organ, right? Everything passes through it, and it does a lot of the breakdown of other proteins, as well as it produces a lot of proteins. It's one of the highest secretory organs in your body, producing a number of proteins. And FGF21 is naturally produced there. That's why it was great for that particular therapeutic. The cells were already doing it. We just had them do more of it. And then it just has a lot of blood going through it. So it has access to the blood supply. So it could just dump lots of proteins into the blood supply.
Interesting. Okay. Thanks for answering. I guess as we're kind of moving towards closing up, a couple of broader questions. So, you know, you and I are both in the longevity biotech field. We often say that targeting aging itself is the most effective way to extend human health span. So as the future unfolds, what kind of impact are you envisioning your therapies having on how we age if they're successfully developed and approved?
I think the potential for these therapies, from our first couple therapeutics that are, you know, liver-targeted gene therapies to the age reversal partial reprogramming therapies, you're going to see a squaring of the curve. And what that means for people that aren't familiar with that term is that you're going to increase the health such that you're going to live healthy all the way up until the end, and then hopefully just drop dead one day. But also you're going to extend that curve significantly so that average lifespan goes from 80 to 100. And it's not just 80 to 100 where you're in ill health taking lots of pills. It's 80 to 100 of good health where you're still mobile, still active, still, you know, playing with your grandkids and great grandkids and so forth. I think the initial therapeutics will show what's possible. We'll be able to get them to a very large population of people. Gene therapy traditionally hasn't gotten to a large population of people. And when we go into millions of dogs, even 100,000 dogs would be a huge patient population. And we're trying to target millions of dogs. So I think it's a great proof point to go into these dogs. It's a great stepping stone to show how good it can be in humans because they have shorter lives. But I think societally, you'll see just an increase in output from everybody who's more able to continue doing what they're great at doing. I mean, imagine somebody that was a Nobel laureate that like started to have Alzheimer's when they were 80 and couldn't keep on going. You know, imagine that Nobel laureate now being able to keep doing what they're amazing at well into their hundreds.
That's a really wonderful vision. And I think it makes a nice place for us to stop. Dr. Noah Davidson of Rejuvenate Bio, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Many thanks as well to our listeners and subscribers. If you have feedback or suggestions for future episodes of Translating Aging, you can contact us by email at podcast@bioagelabs.com, on Twitter @BioAgePodcast, or via our LinkedIn page. You can also follow our sponsor, BioAge Labs, on Twitter and LinkedIn. We'll see you next time.